A dreamer who made his dreams come true, Archimedes of Syracuse. Strolling along the banks of the River Nile many centuries ago, two young men were engaged in earnest conversation. They were students at the famous University of Alexandria and often walked and talked in this manner. But if you and I could have listened in, we would have been amazed at their usual topics of discussion and more than likely would have found the talk beyond our depth, even though we might have been masters of the excellent Greek in which they spoke. "I contend, O Conon," said one determinedly, "that nothing but pure science counts for anything in this world. If we but pierce the secrets of mathematics which Euclid has outlined so ably, we can do all things. We would be the equals of the gods themselves." "I agree, my good Archimedes. Pure science is the goddess of all the arts, but it is also man's handmaiden. Unless it may be made to serve man in his daily life, of what good is it?" "Well, for one thing," returned his friend thoughtfully, "it teaches mankind how to live. Take our beloved university for an example. Where once was a waste desert and hyenas sang to the moon, now rise splendid buildings where sages lecture. The world will always tell of the exploits of Alexander the Great, how that after he had conquered the known world, he came south to the delta of the Nile and built the proud city which bears his name. And what was the keystone and foundation of this city? Mathematics. The architect Dinocrates designed it. The shape, as you know, is a parallelogram, and the streets cross each other at right angles. Each of its mighty structures, temples, palaces, gymnasia, is also built by the aid of mathematics. And look you, lofty lighthouse guarding the entrance to the harbor is the first of its kind in the world. It will doubtless be spoken of for untold centuries to come as one of the wonders of the world. The Library of Alexandria is but another stupendous contribution to the wisdom of mankind. I tell you, Conon, that long after the military exploits of Alexander are forgotten, these things will live. True, O Archimedes, I worship science no less than you do. However, I contend that it is often too abstract. It does not do enough to relieve the necessities of mankind." "Explain yourself, Conon," replied his friend a bit impatiently. "I shall. Do you see those poor Egyptian servants lifting water to irrigate their fields? They are drawing it up laboriously by hand. What has mathematics done to aid them? And yet, many centuries ago, the pharaohs knew the principle of the lever and the pulley. Else how could they have erected the great pyramids out on the desert which challenged time?" "True, indeed," said Archimedes. He had scarcely seemed to hear the last of his friend's speech, for he had stopped abruptly to watch the men at their task, and as he watched, his brow puckered. In the dry season, the Egyptians could keep their crops green only by irrigation. They dug long ditches for the main channels of the precious water, but in order to get the water up to the levels of their fields, men would pass buckets up by hand. It was a back-breaking job. Noting his comrade's abstraction, Conon remained silent, but he smiled to himself and gave a little nod of satisfaction, for he knew from past experience that when Archimedes tackled a problem, something came of it. While they were standing silent there by the Nile, let us introduce them more properly. Both were students in the far-famed university, which was then the recognized center of learning of the whole world. As Archimedes had said, it was a project of Alexander the Great, and was founded about the year 332 BC. To it came the greatest teachers, such as Euclid, and scholars gathered there from Greece, Rome, and Asia Minor, as well as Egypt itself. Its campus, with its confusion of tongues, must have resembled the Tower of Babel. However, Greek was the prevailing and polite language. In the year of our story, about 260 BC, Conon had come down from the island of Samos, one of the Grecian archipelago, to attend the university, and had speedily struck up a lasting friendship with Archimedes of Syracuse. The two had exceptionally fine minds, but Conon inclined to the practical, while Archimedes was a dreamer, dwelling in the realms of the abstract. Yet, at the same time, Archimedes had the alert thinking powers of the born inventor, as his friend had early discovered. That was why Condon wisely left him alone when confronted with the problem of irrigation. The city of Syracuse, where Archimedes was born about the year 287 BC, was one of the most important ports on the Mediterranean. For centuries, it had vied with Carthage and Rome for supremacy. Strategically located on the southeast coast of Sicily and well fortified, it challenged the sea powers of every nation. Like other kingdoms, it had suffered reverses as well as triumphs. But in the time of Archimedes, the city was once more a dominant power under the rule of Hero II, who was to remain on the throne for 50 years. Archimedes came by his love for science naturally. His father was Phidias, an astronomer who had a position at court. The son was on intimate terms with the king and the young prince Gallo, but Archimedes was not the kind to be content with a silver spoon or to potter around his father's observatory with its all too feeble instruments. Even as a boy, he was clever at contriving things, though he himself pooh-poohed their value. He was more interested in difficult mathematical problems. On one occasion, so goes the story, he had shown Gallo how to rig up a pulley. It was along the now familiar lines of a stout cord running around a grooved wheel, and then around a second and a third. By this means, Archimedes easily lifted 100-pound weight. Gallo reported the fact to his father, and King Hero summoned the young man into his presence. Before the court, the test was repeated. The king looked on with close attention. "If you had larger pulleys, you could lift larger weights?" he asked. "Yes, sire, one could lift this palace, if one had a pulley large enough. It is but another principle of the lever. See?" And Archimedes took a strong stick, placed one end of it under the 100-pound weight, put a fulcrum or support underneath, and by exerting a pressure at the longer end, easily tilted the heavy body. This is familiar enough today, but many in the court looked on with astonishment. They had not soiled their hands with manual labor. The king nodded. He knew something of its principle. "And your lever," said he, "how powerful is that?" "Sire," replied Archimedes, "give me a place on which to stand, and a fulcrum, and I could move the earth." This audacious speech, which has gone down into history, made a ripple of both amazement and derision around the court. Hero checked it with a frown. "A bold saying, and one I cannot dispute," he observed dryly. "I fear that we cannot put your lever to the full trial, but this thing you call a pulley, perchance we can give it a larger test. Methinks that if it works, it might stand as well in time of war, no less than in peace." "True, sire," answered the young man quietly. "What test would you propose?" The monarch's eye wandered idly out the windows of the palace to the open sea. A ship was just then entering the port. "Could you rig up a rope so strong that one man could pull that ship?" he asked. "I could, sire." "Done," said the king, rising. "We shall aid you to complete your contrivance at an early day." Keen was the interest of the men and women of the court as they watched the preparations going forward for this strange test. Many were the quiet jests at the inventor's expense. But this has been true since the dawn of time and will always be true. "Archimedes, the world mover, is going to drag a ship into the harbor with his own hands," they jeered. If the young man heard any of these whispers or saw any of these smiles, he gave no sign. He was too much engrossed with the problem that the monarch had put up to him. But instead of building long lines of pulleys and actually testing them, he contented himself at first with drawing geometrical designs and putting down endless rows of figures. At last he told the king that he was ready for the workmen, and a crew of skilled laborers were placed under his charge. We do not know just what form the huge pulley took, except that it was arranged in a series of blocks and tackle, much after the manner of such things today. A long cable was attached to the vessel lying unanchored just offshore. On the wharf was a dais where sat the king, and around him were grouped his doubting but interested men and women in waiting. No matter what the results, they promised themselves a diverting morning. Archimedes went about his final preparations with outward calm. If he had any inner misgivings, he kept them in check. With steady hands, he gave slight tugs to the ropes and carefully noted their response. To the onlookers, the whole performance seemed absurd. Here on shore was an insignificant man, while there lay a great ship. How could he pull it unaided? At last, Archimedes turned and bowed to the king. "Are you ready?" asked Hero. "Ready, sire." "Then pull." "Your pardon, sire, but may I make a request if it seem not overbold?"
"Granted," responded the king.
It seemed to me that the king himself might like the distinction of pulling a ship with his own hands. A gasp ran around the court. The presumptuous young man! The king must not soil his hands, and suppose, as seemed almost sure, he should fail. How would the king like to become a laughing stock? A low murmur was heard. Meanwhile, Prince Gallo had darted forward. Chivalrously, he wished to save the face of both his friend and his father if there should be a failure. "Let me pull the ropes, my father," he entreated, and at the same time he laid a hand on Archimedes' arm. But King Hero had already risen. It was for his human traits such as this that, for half a century, he was to hold the love and loyalty of his people. "I will pull the ropes," he said calmly. Then, as if to reassure the inventor, he continued, "Let us not be content with merely one trial." Laying aside his cloak, the monarch took his place at the spot indicated by Archimedes and gave a long, steady tug at one end of a lengthy rope. His first pull was unavailing, but the waiting throng stood frozen to silence. To laugh now was to laugh at their king. Archimedes turned and gave an order in a low tone to some workmen. "Wet the ropes," he instructed. They poured water on the cables. "Now, once again, sire, a long, steady pull while I count up to 10. 1, 2, 3. How breathless stood the crowd as the precious seconds ticked off. Then a great roar rose from the onlookers. "She moves! She moves!" they cried. The stately ship had indeed responded, and gracefully, inch by inch, but no less surely, was coming into the wharf. Later on that momentous day, 4 persons were closeted in the king's private chambers. They were Hero himself, Gallo, Archimedes, and Phidias, his father. Hero was speaking more as a kinsman than as a monarch. "I do not think this is the opportune time to shower honors upon you, my Archimedes," he said. "But I know that upon you, as upon your father, I base the future safety of my realm. We are beset by powerful foes on every side. By our wits alone may we conquer. Will you not devote your mind to our service?" "As best in me lies, sire," he replied modestly. "But if I may make one request further." "Say on." "I would go to Alexandria for further study. There is yet so much that is puzzling in mathematics." The king laughed and clapped him on the shoulder. "You and your equations. But go." Thus it was that Conon and Archimedes met and fraternized in Alexandria. And thus it was that Conon respected his friend's silence as he stood and pondered the problem of how to get water up to the thirsty land. For Conon had come to know of the Syracusans' exploits at home. They had become famous abroad, as such things will, although Archimedes himself said little about them. This was an oddity in his makeup which Conon found hard to fathom at first. He thought it but a pose, but as he came to know Archimedes better, he saw that his friend really set small store on his mechanical devices. He preferred to work on the problems of Euclid. Suddenly Archimedes looked up with an energetic toss of his head. "I think I have it," he said, smiling. "Come over to this smooth bit of sand." Conon followed him and watched while the other began to draw spirals in the sand with a sharp stick. The figure that he drew looked something like the threads of screws or auger bits. "That ought to do it," he said, pointing. "You place the lower end of this screw in the water. The screw is enclosed in a hollow cylinder, and the whole thing is on an inclined plane. As the slave turns the upper end of the screw by means of a windlass, the screw revolves.
The water enters the lowest chamber and is conveyed on up by successive stages until it pours out at the top. It sounds too simple to work, replied Conan, but if you say it will, I believe you. You do not need to take my word, said Archimedes, with a slight frown of impatience. It will be easy enough to make a small model. The model was made, and it worked just as its inventor had predicted. Full-sized machines were then placed on nearby estates, and soon demands came in for them from far and near, but the inventor himself was no longer interested. Here is the model, he said. Make your own machines. I am busy with my problems. From that day to this, for over 2,000 years, farmers in the East have hoisted water by means of Archimedes' screw. After 2 or 3 years spent in Alexandria, Archimedes returned to his native city of Syracuse. As the years sped by, he became more and more engrossed in mathematics. He wrote books on algebra, geometry, and mechanics. He drew a chart of the heavens and made corrections in the solar year. He studied the laws of specific gravity, or floating bodies, and of this an amusing story is told, the most famous with which he is associated. It seems that King Hero had given to one of his goldsmiths a certain quantity of gold, with instructions to fashion a new crown. It was completed in due course, but the monarch had reason to suspect that the crown was not all gold, that a baser alloy had been used in it. He told his suspicions to Archimedes and asked if there could be found some means of detecting such alloys. It seemed a poser for even the sage's astute brain. For days he pondered the problem, for he never liked to give up on one unsolved. Then one morning, as he was stepping into his bath, he noticed that the tub had overflowed and that the farther he sank, the more water was displaced. Without waiting even to dress, he sprang from the room and from his house and ran, dripping and naked, through the streets to the king's palace, shouting, "Eureka! Eureka! I have found it! I have found it!" His alert mind had at once seen that different bodies would displace different volumes of water, and that gold, being one of the heaviest of metals, would have greater displacement than others. The rest of the problem was easy. He obtained from the king a weight of the precious metal equivalent to the amount originally given the goldsmith, and measured the amount of water displaced. Then he placed the crown in the same bath and proved that it was, in fact, spurious. However, it was in the closing years of his life that Archimedes was to be of the greatest service to his country. He had obeyed the king's request to put his wonderful mechanical genius to work. Under his direction, mighty contrivances were rigged up for the defense of the city in case an enemy should attack. This attack finally came about the year 214 BC at the hands of Roman ships and legions under the famous general Marcellus. The city was besieged on all sides, by sea and by land, and its forces were greatly outnumbered. But the difference in forces was largely equalized by the genius of one man. The siege has gone down in history as one of the most remarkable in ancient times. Plutarch, the historian, has this to say of it. Now the Syracusans, seeing themselves assaulted by the Romans, both by sea and by land, were marvelously perplexed and could not tell what to say. They were so afraid, imagining it was impossible for them to withstand so great an army. But when Archimedes fell to handling his engines and set them at liberty, there flew in the air infinite kinds of shot and marvelous great stones with an incredible noise and force on the sudden upon the footmen that came to assault the city by land, bearing down and tearing in pieces all those who came against them, or in what place soever they lighted, no earthly body being able to resist the violence of so heavy a weight, so that all their ranks were marvelously disordered. And as for the galleys that gave assault by sea, some were sunk with long pieces of timber, like unto the yards of ships, whereunto they fastened their sails, which were suddenly blown over the walls with force of their engines into their galleys, and so sunk them by overgreat weight. These machines he had devised and contrived, not as matters of any importance, but as mere amusements in geometry, in compliance with King Hero's desire and request. Another legend of this siege is that Archimedes made huge burning glasses and set fire to the enemy ships. And still another story is that with one shot from a great catapult, he sent a heavy stone hurtling through an assault tower and totally demolished it. So terrified grew some of the Roman soldiers at the mere sight of some uncanny-looking contraption appearing above the walls would send them fleeing in disorder. They looked upon the sage as superhuman or a magician. The most dreaded word which ran around the camp was, "Archimedes is at it again." Marcellus, the general, regarded him with both admiration and respect. "I would rather have this man on my side than 100 generals," he is reported to have said. For more than 2 years, the city was able to beat off the foe, but fresh reinforcements came continually from the north, and the city's supplies ran low. There came a day when even the wonderful engines of Archimedes could no longer hold back the enemy. Through a dozen rifts in the walls, the soldiers poured in, putting the last of the defenders to the sword. And what of the man who had built these now silent engines? Let Plutarch tell us the story. Nothing afflicted Marcellus so much as the death of Archimedes, who was then, as fate would have it, intent upon working out some problem by a diagram, and having fixed his mind alike and his eyes upon the subject of his speculation, he never noticed the incursion of the Romans, nor that the city was taken. In this transport of study and contemplation, a soldier unexpectedly coming up to him commanded him to follow to Marcellus. This he declined to do before he had worked out his problem to a demonstration. The soldier, enraged, drew his sword and ran him through. Certain it is that his death was very afflicting to Marcellus, and that Marcellus ever after regarded him that killed him as a murderer, and that he sought for the kindred of Archimedes and honored them with signal favors. Marcellus further ordered that a monument be raised to the great engineer's memory. On it was engraved a spear inscribed in a cylinder. It was to commemorate one of the most important of his mathematical treatises. Many years later, the Roman orator, Cicero, in searching through the ruins of the once proud city of Syracuse, found the fallen tomb of Archimedes. Both the city and the engineer had seemingly passed from the ken of men, but Cicero knew better. Cities may come and go, empires rise and fall, yet the wisdom of men shall not perish. Archimedes still ranks as one of the greatest scientists of all time, and we know of the last days of Syracuse and of King Hero, his friend, largely because this sage, with his head in the clouds, passed that way.